Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The clergy abuse scandal in the Catholic Church now appears to be reaching into the higher ranks of the church. A grand jury in Philadelphia spent 2 years reviewing abuse allegations and has issued a scathing report detailing alleged abuse by hundreds of priests and an apparent systemic cover-up by church authorities. This report says church higher-ups have largely escaped public accountability. Some say this is the broadest examination of the clergy sex abuse scandal since the Boston Globe first broke this story about clergy abuse more than 15 years ago. Here's Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro.
As the members of the grand jury wrote in their report, we need you to hear this. There have been other reports about child sex abuse within the Catholic Church, but never on this scale. For many of us, those earlier stories happened someplace else. Now we know the truth. It happened everywhere.
Well, our next guests will talk about that, some of the history of the abuse scandal here in Boston, and how this report from Pennsylvania might affect the church and all abuse survivors going forward. Also, listeners, we'd like to hear from you, and we'd like you to comment about this as well. Does this report from Pennsylvania surprise you? What do you think it means for the Catholic Church or for Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who is chair of the Vatican Commission on Clergy Abuse? Have you been affected by the clergy abuse scandal, and what do you think should be done from here? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. With me in the studio to talk about this is Terry McNiernan. He's founder and president of the organization bishopaccountability.org. Thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
So, Terry, what's your overall reaction, first off, to this Philadelphia report? Some 300 priests, about 1,000 abuse survivors, massive numbers.
Massive numbers. And once you get past the numbers and begin to experience them in the report, there's a horrifying quality to it and also a horrifyingly familiar quality to it. We've seen this before. We've been down this road before, and yet it's all painfully new as well.
Mm. Some of these allegations were so graphic, talking about child pornography, whips, priests using whips and beating people, minors. I mean, is this the most graphic description of abuse that we've seen yet, or are we forgetting over the years?
No, I think you're right that the grand jury, I think, was committed to truly showing us. I think there's always a tendency, a human tendency, to moderate the impact and some reluctance sometimes in newspapers and public fora to being this explicit. And yet I think there's value in reminding people that this isn't just quote-unquote abuse. It's not just quote-unquote fondling. That what these children went through is something truly horrible.
You have been keeping records on abusive priests for more than a decade, right? How many states or grand juries or investigations have been done so far? And do you have a number of how many priests have been identified?
So in the United States, we're seeing this is the 11th or the 10th, depending on how you count. And Pennsylvania is unique in the United States in now having been covered by grand juries from border to border. There were a couple in Philadelphia, one in Altoona Johnstown recently, and now this report that covers the other six dioceses. In addition to that, of course, there have been reports, similar reports, in other countries, including really the mother of all these reports, the Royal Commission report that came out at the end of last year. The absolutely finest work that's ever been done on this.
Why is that?
It's because they had subpoena power. They had command to. They had the power to command the attendance even of Cardinal Pell at their hearings. They had the ability to gather documents on the broadest scale, not simply a single state, as we see in this grand jury report, but the entire country of Australia was subject to the Royal Commission. They had eminent commissioners in charge of it. They had a large staff. They had adequate funding. They produced an enormous final report and thousands of pages of documents online. So some people say this is what we need to aspire to in the United States.
Remind us of what happened here in Massachusetts, right? Boston Globe breaks a story about clergy abuse in 2002. We had an investigation here. How does ours compare? Let's start with maybe not the gold standard, but how about Pennsylvania, what we heard about just yesterday? How does what happened here in Massachusetts compare in terms of investigating this? And then I want to ask you, because it just seems like, oh, it's another church crisis. Why does this seem to keep happening? Is it getting deeper? Is it the way we investigate? So first off, Massachusetts versus Pennsylvania. What's going on there?
So the Massachusetts report was done by the Attorney General. The so-called Riley report was...
Former AG Tom Riley.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Valuable in its way, and it focused really on the managerial aspects of the crisis, not in Massachusetts as a whole, but in the Boston Archdiocese. And we learned a lot about how the abuse managerial effort was organized in Boston. It was not focused, as the Pennsylvania grand jury report was, on identifying so many priests, 301 in the Pennsylvania report, nor was it so graphic and detailed, as you've said, in its description of the managerial problems. But it did have its value. It did not yield any indictments, Riley said, because the laws simply were not written to allow him to pursue the responsible parties so long after the actual crimes had been committed.
Same thing in Pennsylvania, right?
Exactly.
Statute of limitations.
I mean,
so it's sort of similar. So why is it that we continue to have these lengthy investigations? And maybe, is it good? It's an airing, certainly, public airing. And, of course, this is still – there's still legal wrangling, we should say, going on over this report of some folks who think their names should not be included in these allegations and they haven't had a chance to defend themselves. And there's all that legal wrangling going on. But at the same time, we're continuing to hear this, and these investigations seem to be going deeper and broader. So why are we not seeing reform or change, do you think?
Yeah. Well, a grand jury properly would indict, and the criminal process would take its course. That's not possible in the case of Pennsylvania, for example, because the crimes, most of them, except for those committed by two priests, Sweeney and Paulson, are out of statute. So the problem fundamentally is that the statutes of limitations are written in such a way that these crimes are out of reach because... And the Pennsylvania grand jury goes into some detail in explaining this. There's what they call a circle of secrecy around these crimes. The church has been very good at, in a sense, gaming the statute of limitations, keeping these things secret until they really can't be addressed by the laws as they are currently constituted, which is why in Philadelphia, one of the earlier grand jury reports, there were recommendations that the statute of limitations needed to be changed in Pennsylvania. And Shapiro, of course, in this
the
most recent
Attorney General
report,
in Pennsylvania,
has made that recommendation again and has made it very pointed by saying in his press conference yesterday that he expects the bishops to get behind this effort. Whether that will happen or not is anyone's guess.
Okay. I want to remind listeners, we'd like you to weigh in this conversation about the latest in the clergy abuse scandal report out of Pennsylvania yesterday, listing about 1,000 clergy abuse survivors, some 300 alleged abusive priests. What do you think should be done from here? Have you been affected by the clergy abuse scandal, which, of course, broke in Boston in 2002? You can join the conversation by calling 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I want to go to someone who's on the line with us right now who can talk a little bit about this from the victim's perspective, and that is lawyer Mitchell Garabedian. Mr. Garabedian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
So your initial reaction to this report from Pennsylvania?
What took them so long? I have been representing victims for decades. And for decades, I've been hearing about the criminality of abusive priests and supervisors within the Catholic Church. And as Terry aptly stated, there needs to be issues addressed involving statute of limitations. There needs to be transparency. the common thread we saw in Pennsylvania and in Boston and in so many dioceses is secrecy. When the child is sexually abused by the priest threatens the child, who sees the priest as a representative of God on earth. And the priest says to the child, you better not tell anyone, or you're going to burn in hell, or your parents are going to get divorced. And the child believes that. Then when a parent does report it to the pastor or monsignor or the chancery, the parent is told, you cannot tarnish the image of the church. You cannot take that approach. It will hurt the church and many parishioners, and the parent believes that.
You know, is that still going on, though? I mean, I could see it decades ago, Mitchell, but now it's still happening?
Oh, yes. This is religion. Mm. Oh, yes, without a doubt. I get calls from many Boston victims still coming forward who could not cope in their 60s or their 70s, who are in 80 years old, who come forward and say, listen, I've been dealing with this my whole life, and my mother used to go to church every day, mm-hmm. and we were taught to put the church before our family. They're known as cradle Catholics. Mm-hmm. The secrecy is even written into canon law. Canon law states when clergy sexual abuse matters are looked into, they shall be kept secret.
Now, you released a statement today saying that three of these abuse survivors in Pennsylvania contacted you, and they say the names of their alleged abusers, the alleged abusive priests, are not included in this grand jury report. What do you make of that, and can you tell us, Mitchell, about your role with these survivors in Pennsylvania?
Well, I believe it's what has happened in Pennsylvania with regard to these victims coming, these brave victims coming forward, and the list of priests is only the foundation. And the list of priests, abusive priests, is going to grow in Pennsylvania, and the number of victims is going to grow substantially in coming forward. When a clergy sexual abuse victim comes forward, they not only empower themselves, but they empower other victims to come forward. And they're to be commended for making the world a safer place for children. But this is literally the tip of the iceberg. Victims feel, sexual abuse victims, clergy sexual abuse victims feel alone. They feel like they did something wrong. They feel like they're the only victim. They feel like they will not be believed. They have a lack of self-esteem, a lack of self-control, a lack of trust. And when they hear another victim has come forward, they're empowered. And they feel as though, I'm not the only one. Maybe it wasn't my fault.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to take a call right now because, Mitchell, I think you might be able to help answer this caller's question. Laura is calling from New York. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering if the victims can file a civil suit, and if they can, would that make the Catholic Church go bankrupt?
Okay. Well, Lawyer Garabedian, civil suit, is that a possibility? Because we did talk about the statute of limitations and how that can limit legal action, particularly in the Pennsylvania case.
It depends on what state you're talking about and depends on which state the abuse happened. For instance, in Pennsylvania right now, the statute of limitations in civilly allows a person to file before age 30, okay, which is not a very, very large window. So, and Attorney Shapiro discussed the extension of statute of limitations yesterday, Attorney General Shapiro, and he was right. The statute of limitations need to be amended. So, you know, what I do when I represent victims in other states, I retain local counsel to work with me, and we review the statute of limitations. We review the issues in terms of whether the statute is allows a victim to sue not only the perpetrator, but the supervisors, because, you know, or the church, because sometimes you find two different sets of rules. So it depends on the unique facts of your case and the state you're going to be filing suit in. Hmm. Will it lead the church to be bankrupt? Church is the richest institution in the world. I've had so many discovery issues with regard to churches claiming they were broke or didn't have any money, when in fact they were hiding their money in separate corporations like the cemetery fund. So, you know, you're dealing with the richest institution in the world. Ironically, I believe it was recently named that Apple was the first $1 trillion company named in the stock market, the U.S. stock market. Catholic Church was a $1 trillion organization decades ago.
Okay, Mitchell Garabedian, an attorney specializing in clergy sex abuse cases. He's represented more than 1,000 survivors of clergy abuse. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I also want to touch in now with Thomas Groom. He's a professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Deborah.
So what's your reaction to this grand jury report from Pennsylvania?
Oh, goodness. Well, just when we thought that we couldn't be shocked or scandalized or saddened any further, then you pick up today's paper and the headlines, hundreds of priests abusing thousands of children in Pennsylvania alone. I mean, how tragic. Tragic, first of all, of course, for the victims, survivors. But then tragic for the church, because, and for those of us loyal Catholics who hang in with our church, we're so embarrassed by this, we're so disappointed by this, that the institution that should be representing the rich quality of our faith, the rich truths and ethic and values of our faith, the gospel values that Jesus preached and that the church is supposed to represent, all of us fall short, of course, and yet the institutional failure here is just abominable, extraordinary. What will it take for the church to truly address this along the lines that Terry McKiernan and Mitchell Garabedian have been talking? That's where we have to move with this, that this isn't just another, hopefully this is not another report that we add to all the other reports and call for more reports.
Right.
But speaking as a person of the church, when will my church really move to address why did these dreadful crimes happen? Why were they allowed to continue happening? And I think the first question pertains to the culture surrounding Catholic priesthood. I think the second question, why was it allowed to continue happening, pertains to some lack of accountability on the part of our bishops, the lack of lay voices in the structures of the church, in the governance of the church. So I think there's just huge problems and challenges that face the church. I hope we can rise to it, because otherwise this beloved faith of ours that so many of us still find so meaningful, so life-giving, is just being betrayed and to the detriment and to the suffering of such innocent children.
I want to talk for a moment about Cardinal Sean O'Malley, because he has a very prominent role in the Vatican in terms of dealing with clergy abuse. He's the chair of the Vatican Committee. It's got a very long title, but essentially the Vatican Committee to prevent...
Protection of minors.
Thank you. Protection
is
of
the,
minors.
Is the actual, I think the actual title. Thank you.
But I'm just wondering, I want to ask Terry McKiernan this question too. In terms, and I want both of you to weigh in, but let's bring Terry back into the conversation here. Terry, what about the way Cardinal O'Malley, because this is years now that he's been on this commission, the way he's handled this, what can we point to that says that there's been tangible change from this commission and how the church has dealt with this thus far? You're sighing.
I'm sighing a little bit because there hasn't, in fact, been a lot of tangible change out of the commission. In fact, the two survivors on the commission, Mary Collins, an eminent Ireland survivor, and Pete Saunders, felt eventually that they had to leave because they were so frustrated in part by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the former Inquisition, and its role and failure really to step up to the plate in all of this. They ultimately felt exasperated and had to walk out. My personal theory about Cardinal O'Malley is that he is genuinely ahead of the curve in the United States, but not quite in the position perhaps that he's lionized as occupying. He offered, to begin with, perhaps too much of a challenge to the Pope, because the Pope wasn't where he needed to be himself. I think the Pope has only really gotten to the point where he's receptive to this problem because of the crisis that's happening in Chile right now. I think that forced him to attend and to listen in a way that he hadn't before. And I guess my hope is that as a result, O'Malley's stock rises at the Vatican compared perhaps to the Sodanos and other denizens of that peculiar institution, and that as a result, we will see some genuine results out of the Vatican. The commission suggested that there be a tribunal to handle, quote-unquote, bishop accountability. The Pope accepted this recommendation and then walked away from it. He's got to walk back.
Before Professor Groom weighs in on Cardinal O'Malley, we never got to the numbers of abusive priests that bishopaccountability.org has identified thus far. And Mitchell Garabedian says this Pennsylvania report's tip of the iceberg. Do you agree? And how? What percentage of the priests that you've identified so far do you think might represent the entire problem?
Yeah. So the bishops themselves, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, has tallied the number, not the names, but the number of accused priests that they consider credibly accused over the years. That number is a shade under 7,000 priests in the United States alone, of whom we have been able to identify about 4,400. So there are thousands of priests out there, some of them deceased, but some of them possibly laicized, living in communities, that people are not able to recognize as the sexual offenders that they are. Now, as far as this report goes, take the Diocese of Pittsburgh, important diocese included in this report. Now Cardinal Wuerl, when he was bishop there, reported that there were 51 accused priests. This report appears, and lo and behold, there are 90 accused priests, 48 of whom we have never heard the names of before. So that, I think, speaks pretty eloquently to the tip of the iceberg and what might be lurking under the surface.
I want to take a call, too, before we get right back to you. Professor Kathy is calling from Weston. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There was another way that priests abused kids in this. I was 10 years old. I was being abused by an older brother. I confessed to adultery. And instead of getting help, I got 50 Our Fathers and 50 Hail Marys. And it took me 8 more years to figure out how to get out of that situation. To me, that was clergy abuse.
Not taking your report seriously.
I was exactly, and just giving me a penance that said it was my fault, because I've never before and never since gotten 50 Our Fathers and 50 Hail Marys.
Kathy, I'm so sorry for what you've been through. I appreciate your call. I'm wondering, Professor Groom, do you think when we talk about, you mentioned culturally.
What a tragic story we just heard.
It was a very, very tragic.
But please.
And I feel terrible for Kathy, but I'm wondering if it says something about the culture of the church that you had mentioned earlier and how perhaps the church may or may not be changing. We heard certainly with the controversy at the St. John's Seminary in Brighton, Massachusetts, and Cardinal O'Malley launching that investigation, that part of this was because of online posts from seminarians who say that they're part of the Catholic Me Too movement. Are we seeing a change, or what do you think? How would you describe it? What's happening right now?
Well, Deborah, if I could go back to your question earlier about and that Terry was talking about as well, have we made progress? And I think we have to grant that some progress has been made. I mean, the Dallas Charter is somewhat of an achievement by the American Catholic bishops, and indeed, if it would be something similar, it would be implemented throughout the world. The Church Universal would have made progress. Regarding the Cardinal O'Malley, I mean, he's not the Pope, but he's a key advisor to the Pope. And I would put my life on it that one of the chief voices in turning Pope Francis around, as it were, especially regarding the situation in Chile, was Cardinal O'Malley. So that I think he genuinely is committed to the kind of reform and reconstruction and what have you that is desperately needed. Will he be as successful as he could have been? Probably not, but he's certainly committed to it, and I think has a lot of integrity in that commitment and has, I think, some achievements, even though this commission hasn't had the results that we would wish it could have. But it's a long haul, I suppose. And reports like the one out of Pennsylvania hopefully will help move us forward. But I've no doubt about Cardinal O'Malley's commitment to the reform of the church and the church structures that need to be reformed to solve this problem, so that it doesn't simply continue, and that that justice is done, that we have a transitional justice as we move to a new situation or to a better situation, that the people who are victimized and who are abused and so on will get some sense of recompense, justice or something. The Me Too, that would be my fear. I have personal doubts about the advisability of a seminary formation that takes young men and kind of puts them all together in a confined situation in a seminary where they're not, where they take all their courses and all of their formation and so on in this one kind of hotbed. I think it's a recipe for disasters of the kind that we might be seeing. Most of the religious orders don't have seminaries anymore. They locate their houses of formation near a center of good Catholic theology, like in Washington or in Boston or in Berkeley or someplace. And then they have the form, but they come out for their courses and their classes, and they have classes with lay men and women and married and single and people who are preparing for vocations in lay ecclesial ministry. I think it'd be a far healthier environment for training and preparing the priests of the future. But that's this business at St. John's, I think there'll be other seminaries that will also be have such accusations or claims made against them. It could be an opportunity for the church to rethink the whole structure of priestly formation and how we go about it.
Okay, Professor Thomas Groom, he's a professor of theology and religious education at Boston College. He's also author of the book What Makes Us Catholic. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to. Thank you.
Terry McKiernan, founder and president of the organization bishopaccountability.org. Thanks as always, Terry.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.